I was asked to ask people to be sure that their cell phones are turned off before the session begins. The session that is about to begin actually poses a question that I consider to be one of the big religious questions that I think about and that I think the religious people have to think about all the time. And that is, if you'll pardon me for sounding like a university professor, the epistemological question, the question of the source of knowledge, the question of how we know the things that we know. Do we know them because we learn them from religious sources? Do we know them because we learn them from scientific sources? What is the ultimate source of knowledge and the ultimate source of truth? I can't think of two speakers who would be better people to address the subject today than the two speakers that we have. Professor David Berger is professor of history at Brooklyn College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and also the immediate past president of the Association for Jewish Studies. He has written many books, beginning with The Jewish-Christian Debate in the High Middle Ages, and his most recent book is The Rebbe, the Messiah, and the Scandal of Orthodox Indifference. And there will be more about that in the next session that Dr. Berger will be leading. I also have the self-centeredness to say that he was my teacher, and I'm very proud of the fact that I studied with Professor Berger many years ago, and I learned many things from him when I was a student in the classroom, and I continue to learn much from him, from his books and his writings and his talks. There will be a question period after both speakers speak, but now, Professor Berger.
I have to say that when I got off the plane today and went to customs and was asked what I was going to be doing, and I said I would be giving a lecture at a synagogue, the person at customs said, "Do you know Marty Lakshin?" He had taken a course with him. When you talk about the relative importance of the speakers today, I think that pretty much determines the answer. I want to say one other thing right away now is a technical matter. When I finish speaking, I'm going to do something that doesn't look nice or properly respectful, and I want you to understand this has nothing to do with disrespect to anybody in the country. I have the highest respect for the next speaker, but I'm going to run out for a moment, wash, and come back here and begin to listen while eating a bagel. And the reason is that I have yahrzeit today, and I have a custom of fasting till midday when I have yahrzeit. So I haven't eaten anything, and I will do that, and I want it to be understood why. And so, in the 35 minutes allotted to me, let me try to deal with an exceedingly complicated and difficult subject. And it's a difficult subject in my own mind. And that is what is nowadays called Das Torah, the concept that in the title of this talk was called something like absolute rabbinic authority, although that is not an entirely successful effort to capture the meaning of that term. And so let me begin by addressing certain efforts to define the parameters of rabbinic authority, which lie at the heart of the current controversy over this issue. This is often seen as a fundamental dividing line between modern orthodoxy and traditionalist orthodoxy. And so let's look at what at least some of the sources say, and then I'll move to some expressions of opinion regarding the implications of this controversy. One of the classic medieval works describing the mitzvos and their meaning is the Sefer HaChinuch. And the author of the Sefer HaChinuch takes a position on this matter that I would describe as the view that great rabbis can be wrong, but, at least in certain areas, their opinions are authoritative nonetheless. Now, the underlying text in this discussion is the verse that says that you should not stray to the right or to the left from what you are taught by religious authorities. The prohibition of lo sosur yamin u'smol. And the very famous rabbinic observation says, at least in one of its versions, that you have to listen even if they tell you that right is left and left is right. A friend of mine who is who lives in Israel and actually comes very close to being a believer in an expansive version of Das Torah, though not quite all the way, was approached once by lobbyists from the party that was then called Degel HaTorah, that had been established by Rav Shach, the great figure of the Israeli yeshiva world. And the lobbyists told him that he must vote for Degel HaTorah, because Rav Shach is on the level of a person whom you have to follow, even if he tells you that right is left and left is right. This friend of mine, who was at that moment in his professorial mode rather than his frum mode, said to them, maybe you can find a leader who will tell you that right is right and left is left. But this is, at bottom, a very deeply serious matter. The Baal HaChinuch says the following. He says that we were commanded not to disagree with those who bear the tradition and to change their words in all matters having to do with the Torah. B'chol inyinei ha-Torah. And he then quotes the particular mitzvah that I mentioned a moment ago. And he goes on to say that this injunction applies to people through the generations, to rabbinic leaders, apparently not confining it only to the members of the high court in antiquity, although the heading of the mitzvah refers to that court, explains why this is an important doctrine. And he then says what the mitzvah means is that even if they are in error regarding a particular point, it is inappropriate for us to disagree with them, but rather we should act in accordance with their error. And it is better to suffer a single error while remaining under their authority and good judgment. This approach, which is reiterated later in this discussion, clearly indicates that according to the author of the Chinuch, the members even of the High Court in antiquity, of the Beit Din HaGadol, and certainly later rabbinic figures, can make a mistake about matters dealing with the Torah. But one is obligated for reasons of policy that he describes, but this is God's policy, to obey their rulings. So it's all generations, but it's only with respect to what he calls Perush HaTorah, things they have to say regarding the interpretation of the Torah, or in the other version that I read you, Inyanei HaTorah. Then there is a different approach, which takes the position that God inspires rabbinic figures of stature, at least in the high court, the Beit Din HaGadol, to reach correct conclusions. The most important figure in the period of the Rishonim, the medieval authorities to say this, to my knowledge, is the Ramban, who in his commentary on Devarim writes as follows, after discussing this requirement to obey them. He says, moreover, he says, you should believe, or you should think, that they are saying to you that right is right, exactly what my friend suggested. Because the Spirit of the Lord rests on those who serve in his sanctuary. Remember, the high court was in the temple. And this may, and I think does, refer specifically to the high court. And he will not allow, he will not forsake those who are devoted to him. They will always be guarded against error. And so we have a notion of divine aid to prevent error. But as I read the Ramban, this refers to the Beit Din HaGadol specifically. Then, in modern times, in the 20th century, we have a particularly expansive formulation of this, classically formulated, I would say, if you can speak about a classical formulation in such a recent book, in Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler's work, Michtav Me'eliyahu, where you get the full sense of the controversiality of this issue, of the passion invested in this issue, almost of the defining character of this issue for a certain worldview. He is responding to somebody who clearly asked him how it could be that the great rabbis of the pre-Holocaust years had made the mistake that they did by telling people that they should remain in Europe rather than, I suspect the main thrust of this was rather than go to Israel as part of the Zionist movement, but it may refer to other forms of emigration as well. And this is what Rabbi Dessler says. He says, it appears from what you wrote to me that you believe that all the great rabbis of Israel, all of whose deeds were for the sake of heaven, among whom God undoubtedly stood when they met, such as the Chofetz Chaim, and Rav Chaim Ozer, and Rav Chaim Brisker, and Rav Baruch Be'er, and many more, whose little finger is greater than our ability to conceive, let alone those who lived in an even earlier generation, you believe that all of them are capable of making an absolute error. Kulam yit'u ta'us gimura. God forbid, such a statement may not be made in Israel. It is forbidden to hear such things, let alone to say them. And if not for the fact that I understand that you heard this from others, I would not even dignify your remarks with a response. But since I know that your intentions are good, I will elaborate. You should know, he says, that I actually knew some of these people. And I can tell you that even in accordance with the ability of pygmies like us to understand, their intellect, their understanding was frightening. And the depth of their intellect cut to the very depths. Anyone who saw their meetings saw with his senses that at least at the time, I think this is an important phrase, by the way, at least at the time when they were concentrating on matters that dealt with the interests of the Jewish people as a whole, the Inyanei Klal Yisrael, the appearance was awesome to see the enormous sense of responsibility that you could see on their faces. And you would see that the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, rested in their presence. I'm skipping. The rabbis have told us that we have to obey the sages, even if they tell us that left is right. But this does not, God forbid, mean that they certainly made a mistake because I the pygmy sees with my senses that they in fact made a mistake. Rather, what this injunction means is that I should consider my senses to be entirely annulled like the dust of the earth in the face of the clarity of their intellect and the divine assistance that they experience. All right? And he ends by saying, again, that paragraph by saying, this is the opinion of the Torah regarding belief in sages. Zohi da'as ha-Torah begeder emunas chachomin. Here the term da'as ha-Torah is not used in the sense that it's now usually used, although, I mean, it's close to that. Emunas chachomin, I think, is the term that's used here. Belief in the words of sages in a way closer to the manner in which Das Torah is usually now employed. But in any event, here you have the most expansive understanding of this obligation. One is obligated to obey rabbinic scholars because it is an obligation to believe that they are correct and that any perception that I may have that they are wrong is to be discarded altogether. One more report of a rabbinic view regarding the parameters of this obligation. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein gave a talk about this subject. I happened to hear the same talk twice, once in English in New York and once in Hebrew in Jerusalem. His position in a nutshell is that there is no actual obligation to accept the authority of rabbinic scholars nowadays, that is post Talmudic times, regarding policy questions, general policy questions. But, he said, there is a certain irony in the tendency of modern Orthodox Jews to speak dismissively of such rabbinic authority, because it is the worldview, after all, of modern Orthodoxy, that the Torah is intertwined with the entire world and all of life, and consequently, modern Orthodox Jews, more than any others, should consider that someone who is a master of the Torah should have insightful things to say regarding the matters of the world as well. But he added that since this is not, in his view, some sort of, he didn't say these words, but it's clear, some sort of divinely granted insight of a supernatural sort, it's possible for that advantage in insight that a rabbinic scholar has to be neutralized if the rabbinic scholar is not sufficiently familiar with the issues that are being addressed. And consequently, he said, and this deals with another larger question, the fact that many rabbinic scholars today are not conversant with certain aspects of general culture and society makes that insight less reliable when they are asked questions about issues with which they may not be fully familiar. At this point, I want to make a general statement and then discuss some aspects of this issue in the brief time that we have. Everyone who is committed to Orthodox Judaism understands that there is a certain necessity for reliance on authority. Even in matters of pure halacha, rabbis have made rulings and then said, but this ruling, this matter is too sensitive for me to rely on my own opinion, and therefore I will assert this decision, provided that rabbis X and Y, whose position I don't yet know, will be consulted and agree with me. Some modern Orthodox Jews act on issues of important policy, religious policy as well as public policy, with little or no recourse to rabbinic authority, and one has to raise the question as to the propriety of such behavior. The area, the most sensitive area, which I won't discuss on its merits, that's not the issue here today, but probably the most sensitive area in recent discourse, in recent religious debates in the Orthodox world, where the argument has been made that modern Orthodox Jews have acted without the authority of truly outstanding figures, has to do with certain issues regarding women's prayer groups and other matters associated with Orthodox feminism. Again, this is not the issue that I'm here to talk about, and I won't talk about it, but I'm raising it as a striking example of an area where this accusation has been made against certain segments of the modern Orthodox community. And without taking a position regarding any concrete issue, I will say that I think that this is a serious concern for modern Orthodoxy, and that is the excessive independence of authority. However, there are problems, in my view, with the excessive reliance on such an expansive conception of rabbinic authority as well. And so let me begin with a few historical comments. Jews always asked rabbis questions. And they did not confine these questions only to matters that we would see as narrowly halachic. At the same time, there is a history of lay as well as rabbinic communal leadership in the most famous institution of Jewish communal organization, the Council of the Four Lands in early modern Poland and environs. Not all decisions were in the hands of rabbis. There was a lay component of authority here, and the division and organization was complicated, but it's clear that there was some sense that there were areas where laymen and not rabbis made certain decisions. With the rise of Hasidism, the expansion of rabbinic authority took place in a special context. The authority of a Hasidic Rebbe is not based primarily on his mastery of a body of knowledge, on his mastery of texts, although many Hasidic Rebbes were masters of the texts. The authority of a Hasidic Rebbe emerged out of something very different, a kind of connection to the upper worlds, which gave him authority that transcended narrow halacha. And it's perfectly clear that over there, consulting a Rebbe about something that is not halachic in nature was perfectly natural, and the authority of the Rebbe was perfectly natural as long as you believed that he was somehow inspired by some form of divine knowledge. By the late 19th century already, but certainly in the early 20th, this sense of expansive rabbinic authority came to be formulated in the new movement of Agudas Yisroel with the term Das Torah. Exactly why this happened is a matter of historical speculation. Perhaps it was an impact of Hasidus itself. Arguably, it was a response to secularization as a reaction against the weakening of rabbinic authority. Perhaps it's a reaction, in other words, to the constriction of real rabbinic communal authority. When your followers are not obligated to listen to you, there's no communal structure, you make a decision, and it's up to them to decide whether to listen to you. The parameters of this discussion change. On the one hand, you can demand more of voluntary adherence because they are so committed. They've made a voluntary commitment to accept your authority. On the other hand, you might demand less of them because you're afraid that they will leave, an option they now have that they did not have before, in a pre-modern Jewish community where the only way of leaving was to convert to another religion. It seems to me that there is a very interesting and perhaps troubling and paradoxical impact of the existence of the option to disobey. First, it can make it easier for the layman to pay lip service to a belief in expansive rabbinic authority, because with all the affirmations that you make about accepting it, you know deep down that if the rabbi or rabbis tell you to do something that you really don't want to do, you have the option of not doing it. And I don't mean that this is a cynical assertion. It's made with complete sincerity, that I accept this authority, and I mean that I accept it. But if I'm told to do something that I really, really don't want to do, I know that I can ignore this if I need to. One example that comes to mind was that the Rav Shach was reported to have said that the people with children, that people with children in Israel during the Gulf War should not from the United States should not take them home. And there were people in the community that affirms his authority that did take them home. Now, I don't criticize this. I had a son in Israel then, and we did not bring him home, but it was not an easy decision to make. I don't denounce people for making that decision. But it's an example of a case of the option of disobedience. With this in mind, I have become convinced that, and this is a controversial thing to say, I think. I've become convinced, at least tentatively, that the combined institutions of a Council of Torah Sages, Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, and a defining obligation of listening to rabbinic authority, an obligation that actually defines a subcommunity, actually has a paralyzing effect on rabbinic leadership. It doesn't enhance rabbinic leadership, it harms it. Because of three things happen. First of all, there's a Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, and this inhibits individual rabbis from making statements about controversial issues. That's for the Moetzes to do. What are you saying something when the Moetzes has not? Second, within the Moetzes, for a really controversial matter, you need unanimity, which means that if you can't get it, the Moetzes will be silent even if some members badly want to say something. And finally, once the community has defined itself as one that accepts Das Torah, as a leader of that community, you have to worry that you're going to make a statement and then it will not be followed. And if that happens, the entire defining character of that community is undermined, because it becomes evident that, in fact, Das Torah is not accepted when there is a crunch. There are various examples that I have in mind, but I don't want to pursue them. Each of them would be very controversial, and I want to complete the main thrust of what I want to say, and so I won't give examples. But I think that this is a significant, paradoxical, and unfortunate consequence of this development. There is another danger here, in my view, of an expansive conception of Das Torah as it is sometimes formulated nowadays, regarding certain very important aspects of Jewish worldview. The word hashkafa is difficult to translate. In matters of hashkafa, once you affirm that the position of rabbinic authorities whom you consider authoritative represents Das Torah, the opinion of the Torah, as in the sense that Rabbi Dessler understands it, that is, that God makes certain that error is precluded, then any view that is held by a collective of people whom you consider the rabbinic authorities of your time must be the correct view of the Torah, and it must have been the correct view of the Torah throughout history. You are therefore forced almost, and maybe not almost, you are forced to see the entire history of Jewish thought through the prism of the belief system that your Gidolim affirm. Examples. Is it permissible to reject the authority of non-legal pronouncements in rabbinic literature? Agada. The general view in the world of traditionalist orthodoxy today is that you may not do so. And this leads to a rereading of earlier of the intellectual history of the Jews in pre-modern times to try to explain away and even deny that such a view was sincerely held by great rabbis of the past. Another example. This is a kind of personal experience, but it reflects the larger issue, I think, well. I was once sitting at a bris at the Boston Rebbe's Shtiebel in Borough Park, at the meal after the bris. And the tables were roughly like the tables that we had lunch on, where you had benches on each side of a table. Except they were very close together. And I was sitting in the middle, so there's no way I could get up without making four people stand up. And somebody asked me that terrible question that makes professors continue to do research after they become full professors with tenure. The terrible question is, what are you working on? And I said that I was working on an article arguing that the Ramban believed in a natural order, despite certain comments that would seem to indicate that he denied that there is a natural order and affirmed that everything is a miracle. At which point, someone sitting at the end of the bench turned to me, someone I didn't know, and said, this is what happens when you go to college. You distort the words of the Rishonim. The Ramban did not believe in a natural order. The Ramban could not believe in a natural order, because you're not allowed to believe in nature. To believe in nature is a heretical position. It happens that there was a copy of the Ramban's commentary right next to him in the bookshelf. He wouldn't have had to get up. And I asked him to take it down, and he refused to do it. By the way, I later spoke to someone from Lakewood, whom I know slightly, who said that he was right not to take it down, because I might have persuaded him of a position that is against his tradition. And he is therefore not allowed to believe what I would argue, but I might have misled him into accepting it. This is a striking personal example of the issue, which is a larger issue, of rereading the record in order to accord with what is now considered a required belief. This is true with respect to the traditions of previous authorities concerning relations with deviationist Jews. The record of previous authorities, as recently as Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch and Rabbi Soloveitchik, but certainly earlier, regarding the desirability of pursuing general culture on principle. In addition, one is unable to reevaluate a position in light of new developments, so that the establishment of the State of Israel, which might have brought about a reassessment of an anti-Zionist position, since it appeared, as the Rav said, that God had ruled in accordance with the Zionist position by establishing the state, this becomes almost impossible because it implies error on the part of earlier figures, even though they were working with a different set of data. As an aside, I note that the problem of disagreement among Gidolim, among rabbinic authorities, is a constant problem for expansive understandings of the meaning of Das Torah, the assertion of necessary correctness. And there are various strategies that are used to try to deal with it, though I have doubts that they are really plausible. And so I will end with an inconclusive few sentences, but I think that the inconclusive conclusion, which is of course an oxymoron, is precisely the point. the autonomy and religious integrity or religious conscience of the individual is, in my view, central to any serious religious person. We are all responsible for our own religious decisions on one level. Rabbinic authority, on the other hand, is absolutely central in any meaningful reading of what Orthodox Judaism is. This is a necessary, healthy, fundamental tension. Wholly resolving it in either direction can destroy the vitality and honest understanding of the Torah itself.
Thank you very much, Professor Berger. At this point,